Until now, our mission has been that of space law regulation, contact with Earth colonies, and investigation of alien life. But now, a new task. A probe out into where no man has gone before.
He just has to do it the old-fashioned way and not talk to you.
Yeah, that's one option. And another option is just simply to edit you out afterwards. Yeah, that's all things that I could do.
Yeah.
Do you guys want to be given Starfleet ranks or anything like that?
No.
No?
You're fine.
Positive? No?
Have you thought about this?
No, but feel free to call, call yourself Captain.
No, I would only go in as low as Commodore, I have to say. Anyway, welcome everyone to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast, and I am the host, Terry DeFellin, and I'm joined by a magnificent panel, bursting with Star Trek opinions, Graham Sibley.
Hello.
And Derek Mantle.
Hello.
Our first episode is being recorded in September 2016, the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, the original series. And we're going to kick off fittingly with a discussion on the first two episodes of Star Trek. The two pilot episodes, that's being The Cage and Where No Man Has Gone Before. The Cage was commissioned in 1964, was made in 1964, December, produced. So, in fact, Star Trek is a little older than 50 years old. It was not considered to be good enough for a full series, and Where No Man Has Gone Before was commissioned, given the green light, and on the back of that, they went and did a whole new series. Graham, I will start with you. You've probably watched The Cage umpteen times, and I think you watched it fairly recently as well. How well does this story hold up, would you say?
I think the story holds up really well. It's obviously a pilot. It's obviously been put together with very little to go on beforehand. You can see where the influences have come from. I think that very, very famously, Forbidden Planet is one that's often cited to being the sort of the benchmark that it leans towards. But there are other non-science fiction things that it draws from as well. And there has been the criticism in the past that it was seen as too cerebral, as there was much too much thought in there. But I don't think that there's any more thought, any sort of high thinking in The Cage as there is in Where No Man Has Gone Before. I think the Cage itself, as standalone, stands as a good story. You can almost think of it as a Twilight Zone episode, and I think it would stand up quite well.
Yeah, it could easily have been written by Rod Serling, couldn't it?
I think you're dead on there, because, I mean, obviously at the time, you had The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits were very popular series, and I think that later on there's a bit of a crossover with the sort of the Outer Limits, because they use sort of certain stock, sorry, they use certain sets and bits and pieces in the full series later on, but you know. I went back to The Cage just recently, in this week, because I remember watching The Cage when it came out on VHS in black and white. And in fact, I think that Terry and myself watched it at one time.
I'm sure we did.
Yeah. And I actually never saw the colour version, but the later version that came out.
Was that the version that chopped from black and white to colour?
Yes,
When they dropped in the bits from the menagerie.
Up to last week. That was the same version that I had watched and remembered.
Right.
Because I have the DVD box set of the original series, of which The Cage is the last episode at the end of series 3 box set. And I never actually got round to watching that. And so I've got Netflix, and they've recently put all of the Star Trek episodes up on Netflix in the UK, and I watched The Cage off of Netflix, and it was all in colour. I found it a little bit, because it is quite a jarring, the transition between black and white and colour, but I do quite enjoy that. But it's a very clean print. It looks really, really nice. And I was really impressed with this story. I really enjoyed the episode a lot more because it's a much cleaner print. It looks much better. And I really enjoyed Jeff Hunter's performance in this programme. And I do lament the fact that he never carried on. I wonder whether or not you guys have any thoughts on Jeff Hunter or Chris Pike, the character.
Well, my thought about the actor itself, because I found that this version of Star Trek, you know, the first pilot, as well as what we were saying about the case of it harking back to the Forbidden Planet and also other science fiction anthologies at the time, it also harks back to the Western theme, which obviously is predominant, well, the predominant in American television.
Mm. Well, Wagon Train to the Stars is how Roddenberry claimed he sold it to the network in the
50s. And of course, why not get Jeffrey Hunter, who had a great
career in Westerns.
One of my favourites, The Searchers.
The Searchers, what a film. Yeah, one of the best films.
Which was, I think, 10 years before this. So, obviously, he had become a veteran actor by then. And he does look a very mature actor as well, in this, or mature character, which is quite, you know, it's very different from the later Kirk, because Kirk seems to be much more of an action character. And this one, he does seem to be more of a leader, you know, more of your sort of a proper sort of commander.
And is he closer to Picard, do you think? I know that's silly because massively retconning, because Picard was not even conceived. He wasn't even a twinkle in anyone's eye.
He probably is, because you see, there's one sequence that stands out right at the beginning when I was watching last night, was the sequence between him and the Doctor, Boyce. Mm. Because the thing is that his character, he doesn't want to go off on the wild goose chase, so he's very measured, he's trying to consider about his crew and so on. Mm. Unlike the later Kirk, who basically goes in there with two boots straight forward, but it is a different character.
Yeah,
and it is more mature, not as fun as well. But he has a lot of respect.
There's one thing I noticed on just watching it this week. Now, and I'm so familiar with this story that it just amazed me when I just noticed it this first time this week, was when I was watching it and when he's going on in that discussion with the Doctor about the recent battles he was in and about how his only omen and how many of his own crew were injured in there. And when you actually look around, you can see the injuries are all over the place.
Yeah.
Because you see that the helmsman's got his hand strapped up. Mm. One of the guy on the landing party's got a massive plaster on his neck. And Spock's got a limp.
Spock is walking with a limp, yeah.
I never noticed that.
Yeah, but
planet
side. Okay. Yeah. It's the most obvious when they go planet side and he's walking with a limp. And I didn't pick up on that myself until the last time I watched it. And I think a lot of this is because we're watching a clean print. I'd seen this episode so many times with the VHS print.
Yeah.
And it's transitioning between black and white, and it is not a very good picture quality at all.
Mm. I think there's a problem with the sound as well.
And they partially deal with that with the newer version of it, but it's still, it's still noticeable a bit. And I've seen it so many times, I know exactly where the bits from the menagerie are and where the bits from the cage are. I know where the bits that were taken into the menagerie were, and that it's that. That's just how familiar I am with that. So I can recognise the differences in the zookeeper's voice as well. In the original print, the original version, it was voiced over by a man, but for the menagerie, it was a woman. I think it might even have been Meg Wiley, the actress's voice, but I might be wrong about that. But it's those little things you just don't notice. Just quickly go back to that Dr. Bartender scene, because it's quite pivotal in my view in Star Trek, because it also, I think, outlines that philosophy. One of the philosophies about Star Trek going forward, and in the importance of struggle, when Pike is thinking about jacking it all in and retiring to back home to the Orion Belt, the Dr. Boyce sort of like makes this speech about how
a man either lives life as it happens to him, meets it head on and licks it, or he turns his back on it and starts to wither away.
And it's a theme throughout the episode. I think it's also a theme that is very prominent in Roddenberry's thinking. I don't know what you guys think about that.
I think I think what you've always got to go back to in with the cage is the fact that it is a showreel, and it is meant to show up what what the series is going to be like. And so to get as many different aspects into there as possible, and the Cage really does shoehorn a lot in there. The one-to-one with Pike and Boyce is very much sort of thing. Well, this is the things that we're going to return to over and over again about how we analyse what we do and why we're doing it. And of course, starting with an end is always a great thing anyway in any sort of show or piece of fiction. And when you've got a character who really thinks, right, I've washed, I'm done, I'm finished.
You bet I'm tired. You bet. I'm tired of being responsible for 203 lives, and I'm tired of deciding which mission is too risky and which isn't, and who's going on the landing party and who doesn't, and who lives and who dies. Oh, I've had it, Phil.
Basically, someone who's actually now going to turn around, and this is going to be the kickstart of the series, of the fact that, you know, he's gone from being at the bottom to actually finding himself and thinking, right, okay, now I can go up.
And of course, we've got this kind of redemptive story going through the case. The pilot episode serves as that, so that when we get to the end of the story, he is completely energised and ready,
let's
ready to
go out
the way.
Yeah,
absolutely. Not so much concerned about going back to Vega Colony and tending to our sick and injured, and maybe handing in my resignation. But you know, we're going to move forward.
I was just going to ask actually, what do people think about the attitudes on the actual, if you watch the episode, there's one very funny bit with where you have the yeoman on the actual on the bridge, and his attitude to the yeoman. I want to bring this up because my daughter actually sat down while I was watching this episode a couple of days ago, then when there was the bit about the sort of confrontation between Pike and the yeoman, and also number one about a woman being on the bridge. And I was just wondering, compared to the sort of attitudes of you know, this program about, because Star Trek's always been a case of pushing forward, you know, sort of like progressive attitudes. But I also found that attitude with Pike's character to be quite old-fashioned as well. He did seem to be very an old-fashioned character.
Yeah, I think it is a show that tries to be progressive, particularly on gender issues, but is still very much a product of its time and the prevailing attitudes of the time.
I think we go back to this wagon train to the stars, and basically the a lot of the attitudes in there are quite Victorian along with it, so they've carried their attitudes from that sort of period as well.
I did actually, it's quite good that you've done that, because it does link in quite nicely to the next character I did want to talk about, and that was, I mean, was number one, the first officer, who sadly didn't make the cut when the show was extended, when there was a new pilot was brought in. Obviously Majel Barrett, Roddenberry, or Majel Barrett as she was then, plays a female first officer, a controversial selection. I never felt that she was entirely comfortable in that role, and I don't know whether or not that was because it's women didn't get to play roles of that kind back then, and maybe that was what it was, or maybe it was she was just a bit too nebulous a character. It would have been interesting to see her develop.
I think it's interesting because I think I don't want to go too much into the next one, but I think if you look at the two pilots and you look at the character of number one and you look at the character of Dana in When No Man...
Dr. Dana,
In When No Man Has Gone Before, and you see two similar characters and two characters who are treated the same way as well.
The walking freezer unit.
Yeah, basically. And that's exactly what they are. They're sort of these professional women on the bridge, and denigrated because of that.
And also reinforcing the stereotypes. We literally word for word saying female professionals tend to overcompensate.
Yes.
Which is a line that is a contemporary line. I mean, it's set in the 23rd century, but it is a contemporary line.
You know? This is, what, mid-60s, so I mean, the women's liberation movement is only just kicking off in there. But I mean, Southern California, there would have been quite a bit of energy behind that, especially on the student campuses. Whether or not that would have actually bled into the TV studios, I don't know.
I guess the people who made that show are a product of that time as well, and are influenced by what is going on around them.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all relatively young. And energetic and aware. And so that is reflecting. I'm happy to transition into when Aaron has gone before,
but I would like to say one thing about the cage, and one reason why it probably wasn't picked up. And I wonder if someone sat there actually thought, hang about, they're taking the mick out of TV here, aren't they?
Do you think so?
Yeah, I think it's a satire against TV. Because the whole Talosians living in a fantasy world, just basically not being able to do anything anymore. All they're doing is consuming.
Yeah. And when Vina is having this conversation in the picnic with Pike, and she's saying they found it to be like a drug, like a narcotic, you know, and how their society is withering away by this form of mass entertainment.
This is too intellectual for the.
Well, maybe this is the intellectual thing that they were worried about.
We're going to give these guys billions of dollars, and they're going to end up taking the piss out of us for the next 25 episodes.
That's what it seemed to be to me. Whether I'm not, I'm putting another 50 years worth of analysis on top of that or not. But we can only
analyse it in that context. Yeah, I mean, we can't transfer ourselves back to the 1960s.
Can I throw one last thing?
Please.
Right? Yeah. I mean, there is an interesting thing that obviously comes off the point of view about the dreams and the unreality sort of part of the story. One of the most famous bits from the actual cage that was taken in as the end sequence to all of the Star Trek, the original series, obviously was the Orion girl, slave girl.
Yeah.
And one thing I actually found a little bit unsavoury, actually. There was the sequence where Pike is actually given all of his desires or things that he wants, sort of thing. And there's the sequence where he's gone into that sort of dream where he's sitting there in this harem type thing.
Basically a strip club, isn't it?
A strip club with two other guys. One's a Starfleet officer and this other sort of fat trader, and he's in the middle looking actually quite uncomfortable with this really weird costume that he's wearing.
Purple cloak he's wearing.
Well, yeah, and he's looking, and he's like, his face starts to go into a sort of a look of disgust because he knows that he's been manipulated. But there's also all these blokes leering at the Orion's.
He's being pushed to his absolute limit at this point in the show, because they are appealing to his basest possible darkest instincts, and I mean Susan Oliver, her performance in this episode is brilliant.
It's good,
She plays different types of characters and she plays them very well, and the Orion slave dance is well known, an iconic image used at the end credits for a lot of Star Trek episodes, and one that's etched into the memory, probably responsible for the sexual awakening of many a young person. So I really enjoy the visceral nature of that scene. I agree that it is problematic, and we will encounter problematic tropes and elements within Star Trek for as long as we're talking and doing this podcast. Mm. And so we can agree that it's definitely problematic. But I think that what they're trying to do is they're trying to really get under Pike's skin and get him to yield by appealing to his, very primitive sexual desires. And we never quite know. We assume it doesn't quite work because they've brought in Number One and the Yeoman to into the mix by that time, and we're never entirely certain whether or not the things escalate. I think that
was a weird moment as well. Yeah,
that
given a choice of three women.
Yeah, I know they don't make them like that anymore, do they? It's probably fair to say we haven't spoken about Spock, but we don't have to because we can do that very shortly.
Yeah.
But just a quick note on the Talosians. Meg Wiley played the zookeeper in this, and big heads that they've got and the bulging veins. Mm. Really proper alien.
Yeah.
And fantastic stuff, and the kind of metal wool that they're all wearing.
I mean,
just the aesthetic is gorgeous in those.
Mm.
So shall we move on to Where No Man Has Gone Before? No Man Has Gone Before is the second pilot, an unusual, if unheard of, in the 1960s for a pilot to be given another go, for them to say, well, look, we didn't like this one, but there's enough in it to have another go. So they did, and Jeff Hunter dropped out, James Kirk was created, and William Shatner, the great William Shatner, is brought into this, and The idea being that it's supposed to be a slightly more action-packed, less cerebral, less intellectual. But as you indicated, Graham, that really isn't the case. I think maybe just it was better paced than the case.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think you've got to look at the first scene with Mitchell and Kirk in the sick bay, when he's just got his powers and he's consuming stuff, and it's really interesting. It's another one that I never picked up on until I just saw it again this week. Was when he goes on about the I'm reading your long hair books, and he's going and he talks about Spinoza, and this is a quite a sort of like esoteric sort of character there, because you're talking about like a 17th century Dutch philosopher who specialised in ethics and interpretations of the Bible, and you've got to think, wow, that's not a lot of people know about that stuff. So then you're sort of building it in, weaving it into the story about a man who thinks he's becoming a god. So that is really quite cerebral. I think there's probably more thought, there's more intellectualism in When Amun Has Gone Before than there is in the cage. But what it has got is you've got a captain who's willing to stay on and make a series.
Yep.
And you've also got a plot line that doesn't really, isn't actually a thinly veiled parody on television.
No, it's a much more bog standard plot, isn't it, Derek? I mean, it sets itself up nicely with the Great Barrier and a big action sequence with lots of explosions, and it goes from there. And of course, it's got the eyes, and introducing a horror element as well, which I think gives it a kind of veneer of being quite action packed and pacey and dynamic and energetic.
I think that the horror aspect, you point out, this is very interesting, is that I think that most horror, when it comes to things like Star Trek or any of those sort of things, are very effective when it affects a person. Now, the thing is with the first pilot, we did have aliens.
Yeah.
But they're the other. They're not the actual person who's being.
It's not invaded. The enemy within.
Yeah,
doesn't have any reference to.
Interesting that you use that expression, and I wonder if we'll come back to that.
But you know, the case of what actually makes it more frightening is actually if a normal person is actually infected with something. That's the real horror that we.
And it is an infection, isn't it?
It is. You know, it's sort of. And what's quite interesting about it, I mean, go back to the intellectual point about it, there is a lot of intellectual parts to it, but it's all. It moves at a faster rate. So it doesn't dwell on it at all.
No.
If you pick up on it, it's because you know.
Yeah.
You are really looking for the extra meaty parts of the meal, you know. So I think that's very successful, and it is a faster. It does seem to be faster. There seems to be. I love the first sequence with the barrier at the edge of the Milky Way.
Yeah.
You know, fair enough. I've actually watched the newer version on the Netflix, which is the remastered version.
Obviously, special effects a little bit.
But obviously, when you know, even all those years ago, when I watched it as a kid, it was still quite magical. But I think that the whole thing, I think, is actually an excellent story. It rips through it. Got the proper relationship between the characters, which make it even more. You're more invested.
Yeah, you've got Kirk and Mitchell, haven't you? Which is the
buddies.
Because at this point, Spock is still. And we're conscious of the fact that we haven't spoken about Spock.
Yeah. And there's no bones in there as well.
There's no bones. No, that's true. So Spock is not an important character necessarily, or he's more of a kind of the conscience of Kirk in this one, isn't he?
It's weird because you could take out Spock from those scenes. There's the one scene where Spock comes up with the right thing to do.
And we've got to go to Delta Vega. We've got to maroon this guy and fix the ship.
And Kirk is saying no, we can't do that. But that's the last line is the him doing exactly that.
Yeah.
If you mean strand Mitchell there, I won't do it. The station is fully automated. There's not a soul on the whole planet. Even the ore ships call only once every 20 years.
And you have one other choice. kill Mitchell while you still can.
And it's really that yes, you're right. It's Spock is Kirk's conscience, isn't it? Well, he's not his conscience. He's logical mind saying, right, this is
the character.
So the conflict there is actually an internal conflict. It's just expressing it on the outside.
Yeah, it? And I think that's what it works really, really well. And Spock is quiet because he's a big fella and he's carrying the phaser rifle. Yeah. He's very, very undeveloped as the Spock that we know him to be. But I mean, it's still there's the trace elements of Spock's character beginning to come through. But the ruthless logic of his reasoning, the sort of, you know, we have to do something really unspeakable to this guy that you have known has saved your life. You know, you're his best friend, but sorry, you're gonna have to kill him, basically.
Yeah, and I think that's probably why we're not really gone to Spock that much in this, because there's not a lot to him other than just being a facet of Kirk's personality.
Well, also, you forget that Gary Mitchell is actually Spock's role later on.
Gary Mitchell is supposed to be first officer on the ship. Although that's really
but also the other sort of thing is that, see, I always saw Spock as being Kirk's best mate on board. Obviously with Bones, but they are part of his proper backup. You know, his best mate. They sort of insinuate that, obviously. Well, you don't see it very quickly. You do see it, because obviously there's all the backstory about them being best mates, going through academy together, all the first, you know, first assignments and so on. And they are supposed to be best buddies, more so than Spock and Kirk.
Yeah,
later on.
Yeah, no.
So you haven't got a relationship yet.
No, but with all of this has yet to develop, hasn't
it?
In the first half a dozen episodes.
But also, it makes sure that sort of the thing that happens to Mitchell is actually more effective. The obviously the decision to actually have it to either kill him or leave him somewhere is actually much more of a dilemma.
Yeah, I've got a crazy theory about Where No Man Has Gone Before, and it was one I cooked up just as I was watching it last time. And it's the fact that when you look at Kirk, especially straight immediately after watching The Cage, and you see William Shatner is playing it in a very sort of strict role, very much in the role of that Geoffrey Hunter had done in the previous pilot. There's not a lot of the sort of like the maverick sort of character that he would go on to become, and especially not the womanizing character that he would become. That is all on Gary Mitchell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah.
On Mitchell, and it's just the fact that he's the sort
Lothario.
Of yeah, and he is, and in fact he's actually. Although he's liked by everyone there, he's actually quite a nasty piece of work, really.
Do you think so?
Yeah, I mean, he's manipulative. And anyway, the snide comments that he gives Dana when she turns down his advances.
Walking freezer unit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unpleasant.
Yeah, he's just an unpleasant character, really.
Yeah.
Also likeable. So he's...
Do you think that Mitchell was maybe the cool guy at the academy, and because he describes Kirk as the stack of books with legs.
Yeah.
Kirk is a geek in this scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Kirk learns perhaps some valuable social skills from Gary.
No.
And maybe even protects him from, you know, not bullies, but from, you know, helps him through some of the more social elements of the
academy. Yeah, and he's needed there for him to be actually up to when he's the commander of a starship. He needs someone there like him to be around. And I don't think, or maybe this is an element, you know, someone could, if you ever wrote something to go alongside this, to say that actually Kirk has a change of personality after these events, and maybe with the whole sort of like, mind powers that Gary has, he actually transfers some of his personality to Kirk in those moments of death.
I like that. I do like that. That has obviously come up since in Star Trek, you know, transferring personalities to other people. It's I like
that.
Well,
it's actually like in the, if you look at Star Trek 3, in the way that McCoy acts.
Oh, yes.
Profound telepathy the guy's got. So maybe he did. Maybe there's a little bit of Gary left in Jim Kirk. his gregarious Lothario side.
And that may have happened when we get to the transporter incident where Kirk is split in two, that conflict is actually brought
see,
out.
Now, what would have been really cool would have been if they'd been split in two and Kirk's, quote, evil side actually had silver eyes.
Oh, there you go.
It's quite interesting about the silver eyes thing because I did actually read about those contact lenses that they use.
No.
The thing is that it seems that sort of... the actor who plays, you know, Gary Mitchell...
Gary Lockwood. Yeah.
Had so much problems with it, he had to keep... tipping his head back all the time.
Yeah,
so
it was agony.
But it does create a really weird effect that he looks like he's looking down on people. Like, you know, he's lifting himself, making him much more superior.
The way that they handled that was as he approaches, well, godhood for better one word, but as they get to the end where he's greying, presumably with the sheer stress of it. I mean, you do, thinking back of it now, and you think that unless he was able to sort of like literally transcend away from his body, his human body would be too frail and would just collapse. And I think that brings us on back just to the message of the story. There's a great one of many, many future, the first of many great monologues from Kirk about absolute power and, you know, despite human frailty and like what you see and all of that. It's a great sequence there, but it is the message of the show, isn't it? Is that you know, to beware huge amounts of power, and perhaps informed by, you know, I mean, all of the people watching this would have lived through the war, and many of them would have lived through the war and the experience of dictatorship. So there's perhaps a broader thing, but also the message of not having things delivered to you too quickly. Again, this notion that we're all supposed to struggle to get to where we need to be rather than take shortcuts.
It's an interesting way of looking at it, and I think you're probably right. I mean, there was lots of stuff going on in especially in America. Obviously, this is where it's made. It's for the American audience predominantly. And lots of different sort of ways. I mean, you remember the sort of Soviet Union was around at the time, and there was a lot of American policy against the sort of like the communist ideal about, you know, you take everything from the sort of like the rich people or even just the normal people and spread it around to each other. The idea that you have to go forward, you have to, you know, get things yourself and so on, and, you know,
but it's also a bit of that. It's projecting a view that, of course, in the future, nobody gets left behind and everyone is included. These are issues that we will explore in great length, in greater detail, and we're coming to the end of this podcast because we don't want to take up the listeners' time too much.
No.
But I did want to just make a couple of just points. What do we think about the aesthetic, the costume? Bearing in mind, Star Trek Discovery, the new TV show, is set in between these two episodes. It's set 10 years before the original series. And the menagerie, according to the menagerie, the cage is set 13 years before the menagerie, so the first series of Star Trek. So this new series sits in between. So the aesthetic is important on these because it could inform and perhaps does inform the new series. What do you think of the look of the Enterprise interiors, the uniforms? What do you reckon?
Well, it gets quite a lot of it there already. Obviously, there are some differences in the equipment they use. I love the communicators from the cage.
Do you really?
Yeah.
I love the fact that it's see through and you can see all the gubbins inside. I think they're gorgeous. Do you not like them?
I think they look a little bit too basic for me, but
I was always wondering whether they were iOS or the Android.
Yeah, maybe they were.
And then obviously the lasers, the hand lasers.
Yeah, look, I love those lasers. With the twisting barrel. Yeah,
they actually look like setting. Pepper grinders, don't they?
Yeah, they probably were.
Yeah, no, those things. But the uniforms are gorgeous.
And the jackets that they wear on landing party as well. I really hope we see a lot more of that. This is what I wanted to see when Enterprise was done. I wanted them to use the cage as the jumping off point for the aesthetic and go backwards, but they didn't. They used present day and they kind of went present day sort of NASA and then went forward for Enterprise, and I was a bit disappointed with that.
The costumes in Enterprise were a bit sort of...
It's much less, as a tone, there's much less vivid colours, isn't there? Because in the original series, is obviously commissioned partially to sell colour television. So
yeah.
They've changed the uniforms. They've made it a lot more red and yellow and orange and blue.
Yeah, I think that's it. Because you don't see the red. There is that too. The difference in colours of the command uniforms and the other uniforms is barely noticeable. One's a sort of like a dusky yellow, and one's a dusky orangey sort of colour, isn't it?
Mm.
And you know, an older prince, you couldn't really see the difference between those ones at all. But yeah, you're right. It's because it was up against series like Batman, Mission Impossible, the ones that Batman especially that was being sold to get people to say, look, have your colour TV and you can see things that are amazingly bright and colourful as this, and Star Trek went the same way, really.
Yeah.
Especially with the lighting, it was more about the lighting, wasn't it, that really did that.
Yeah.
And you saw that as well in a little bit. You had a taste of all of that with the effects in Where No Man Has Gone Before, with the barrier effects and that.
Well, what I really liked also that I've always liked about Star Trek were the matte paintings in the background. We saw a couple of those in the
the mining place.
Yes, that was fabulous. Fabulous.
Albert Whitlock is the matte painting artist. He did the cage, the castle in the cage, and Delta Vega, and a few others as well.
But they would have obviously, as you said, it was the colour TV, would have looked lovely.
They would have looked absolutely great. Yeah.
And the one of Mojave as well in the background. That's right.
All the same guy, a guy called Albert Whitlock.
Wow.
Very, very, very talented matte paint artist.
The last thing. If you do feel inspired to go and watch Where No Man Has Gone Before, when you get to the barrier scene, there is a wonderful thing that I noticed there. When they're just coming up to the barrier, and Gary Mitchell, like, he holds the hand of the yeoman.
Yes, I noticed that.
And she looks so bored. She looks really, really bored by the whole thing. So have a look at that. See if you can pick that out.
She's probably fed up of being hit on by Gary Lockwood for the whole sequence. And I think on that somewhat puerile note, we'll bring things to a close. Well, it so ends our first podcast. Thanks very much. That whizzed by.
Yeah.
Thank you indeed very much for listening. We will be back probably in 2 or 3 weeks' time with another episode of Whom Pods Destroy. And I hope that you take the time to listen to it then. We'll give you contact information about the show in due course once we've found our feet, and indeed once you've found your feet. Thank you for your time, and goodbye.
She has an illusion, and you have reality. May you find your way as pleasant as